I think that's the basis of a real rich parenting environment, is this willingness and ability to sit down in many ways and many occasions and have kids share their ideas, share their understandings, share their feelings, ask questions, answer questions. That's the beginning.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
I've been working with Wonder Tree for 21 years, and certainly not as an educator or a teacher, but more as a father. The entire work that I've been doing around learning was really inspired by my daughter and my observations of her the first 5-6 years of her life. And I was transformed by watching her learn how to talk. The evolution of learning in a natural way was so profound that when she walked out of kindergarten after 2 weeks, I thought, you know, we've got to be able to support young people to learn and to get them to not have to impose the industrial factory model of education on kids. And so I started working with her much in a home learning environment, and pretty soon I had 10 kids and stuck with those 10 kids for about 10 years. We also created a high school at one point, a very successful experiment in natural learning. My daughter's 26 now. I wrote a master's degree thesis, and then I'm now working on a PhD. I'm attempting to understand and explain a whole new way of thinking about learning and a whole new way of working with children that fundamentally is based in respect and then evolves a technology, a language-based technology of how do we speak respectfully to kids, and then what is the technology of learning? It's an epistemological question in the sense of how do we work as human beings? How do we think? How do we remember? How do we understand? So it's become an opportunity to work with kids in a respectful way and allow their natural genius and their excellence to unfold as a way that we all develop and all should develop. And it's a question of how do we support this natural unfolding of our human intelligence. I don't teach. It's not a model about changing the classroom or making schooling better. It has nothing to do with schooling. It has nothing to do with classrooms or education. I think the industrial model of schooling is a rather recent experiment and insult that emerged out of the industrial age and the need to have obedient workers in our culture. And so when I really looked at how do I design an appropriate learning experience, I didn't look to schools at all. I didn't try to improve them. I totally ignored them. And what I did was I looked at a human individual, my daughter, who I was intimately able to observe, and then a group of kids. And so when I say I worked with them, it meant that we met every day in a learning center, and that the curriculum as such, I mean, I define curriculum as experience. So learning is something that we do as we live. It's something that emerges as a change in the way we understand who we are and how we work with the world. And so as a natural process, it emerged out of the conversations that the children and I had each day, what we were curious about, what mattered to us, what emerged in the screens and the interests of the kids became the work we did in learning. And this went on for 8 or 9 years. And then we moved into a high school program where we continued to give the kids freedom to create their curriculum out of their own curiosity. We never had a high school. We never had a, you know, we just really went back to the pre-industrial model for learning, which was the village and the community and the family. And the mode of learning that was really excellent at that time was apprenticeship, which is based on what we do naturally when we learn, which is to model. As a species, our forte is learning. And so we're designed to model and get strategies from the people who are good at things around us. That's built formally into a mentoring apprenticeship kind of relationship. So very much a part of our program was opportunities for kids to model excellence. And we had a budget that for the first 4 years of the program, we didn't have funding from the government, but I did charge tuition. That money went into an account, and that account, that money in that account was accessible to the kids. And we worked together as a management team and decided who we would hire and how that money would be spent and what we would buy. And we would often interview 10 people every September and then 10 new people every January. And we would hire 6, 7, 8 of them to do pottery with us, to do clowning, to do story writing, whatever the kids felt was exciting and important to them at that time. It's still going 21 years later. It's a small program, you know, still in Vancouver. It was kind of a laboratory for me to do my research and to experiment with community-based, family-based, natural learning, to allow kids the freedom to explore their own interests. I'm really interested in the post-industrial village, living sustainably on the planet. I have a huge admiration for home learning, and I've decided that the optimum model is not my little experiment, but a larger community of learners. And what I've done is, both in Colorado, where I am now, I've got an experiment down here that I work with, and then there's one in BC. The one in Colorado has 700 learners. The one in BC will have 500 in September. And this is largely a model of learning that goes beyond schooling and beyond home learning. And so what we're doing is we're getting government funding and we're hooking people together through the internet into a village, a metaphor of a village online, where people can have all kinds of conversation. We're using the funding to give directly to learning consultants to work with families and directly to the families. So in the United States, each family gets $2,000. In Canada, we're getting 50% funding from the government. So we give every learner $1,000 to invest in their learning that year. So it's become a quite a large network. Last year we had 100. This year we've grown to 500 learners with 1,000 parents and 50 consultants that work with these kids in groups of 10 or 15, all online. Sometimes in local communities they get together. Home learning families are very strong, very resistant to the influence of things like computers. So people got into the village online. We do a weekly observation and reflection on what the kids are learning as a way of professionally influence the learning process and more informing the learner and supporting the learner, you know, certainly not taking charge of it or not telling kids what to learn, but really just helping them in their own process. And really, it's an advisory role. But it's a weekly process, and we do that online. And a lot of the parents, when they first got on, were quite resistant to this idea of a virtual village. And they said, look, you know, our friends in the neighborhood, those are the real relationships we have, and this is just virtual. But really, conversation, I mean, we're talking over a telephone. This information will be shared over a radio. I think it's really important to have the technology become transparent and to really look at the fact that what we're really doing here is we're creating conversations and relationships and understandings between people of similar interest. Certainly what's happened in our village in the first 2 years is that people, although they live in communities, often are misunderstood in those communities because they're different. And so what they found is a wonderful camaraderie of like-minded home learning families who can share ideas, share resources, discuss the problems and difficulties. An actual community has emerged that is so rich and so exciting. What's happening is the people are spending holiday time together. They're driving across the country to meet their new neighbor that's 1,000 miles away, but the kids are in such rich conversations with each other that friendships have been created out of shared interests and shared feelings.
Well, we've got company coming, there's so much to do. Let's work together for this hullabaloo. Time to clean up and wash up, get the towel and shampoo. We've got company coming, yahoo! We've got company coming, what a day this will be. We'll all be buzzing round like bumblebees, and everyone will bring their favorite recipes. We've got company coming, we'll find some time to sit and talk, share a feeling, or go for a walk. Let each other know we're glad we came, and every time we do this it will be the same. 'Cause we've got company coming all night and day. Some live nearby and others far away. This is a happy time, would you like to stay? We've got company coming, hooray! We'll find some time to sit and talk, share a feeling, or go for a walk. Let each other know we're glad we came, and every time we do this it will be the same. 'Cause we've got company coming all night and day. Some live nearby and others far away. This is a happy
I'm Noam Chomsky. You're listening to CFMU 93.3.
We live in a very authoritarian culture where we're told what to do in direct ways by people in authority and subtle ways by people in the media. Very much a controlled language style. Certainly the model for parenting has been, and for generations, is a lot about authority and control. And the kids don't understand a lot of things, so we think that gives us permission to tell kids what to do. The free school movement was a pendulum swing from that to a permissive kind of environment where we didn't tell kids at all what to do and allowed them the freedom to explore and discover. And, you know, that's a very important experiment. And I think what we're attempting to do is to create a new and third position, which is not authoritarian and not permissiveness. And it comes out of engagement, engagement of equals and real involvement with kids as equals, so that the relationship that emerges is one where each person is an authority for themselves. So as an adult, I get to represent what I think and feel and what I'm observing, and I, in the same way, I want to be heard and respected for that. I create that kind of a relationship with a young person. And so it's really both an enfranchising and a validating of the child's worldview as legitimate for them. It comes down to a very open-ended conversational environment. One of the things that, when I was researching my PhD thesis, I discovered that there was an experiment in the States where they researched 15,000 families to find out how many minutes or hours of conversation they engaged in a week. And virtually none of the families engage in conversation anymore in the United States. And it was down to a few seconds statistically, and that means a few families were having conversations. But when families don't eat together anymore. I mean, that's an optimum place for busy people to stop and sit down and have conversations. And in my studies of people who are doing excellent in their lives, one of the real big factors is, gee, we had great conversations. You know, Mom and Dad and the kids and I talked for hours at the dinner table. And now we have a culture where that's not even happening. So the importance of conversation, and conversation is not defined as, have you done your homework yet? Have you, take out the garbage? It's time to go to bed. These are not conversational pieces of language. It's just really important, I think, to start the dynamic of relationship around conversation and around the, you know, I think if we all sat down and thought about the real aspects of conversation that we've enjoyed that are really rich, I think we could probably come up with 20 qualities and principles for conversation, and then we could, you know, really ask ourselves if we in fact have those kinds of language relationships with our kids. And I think that's the basis of a real rich parenting environment, is this willingness and ability to sit down in many ways and many occasions and have kids share their ideas, share their understandings, share their feelings, ask questions, answer questions. That's the beginning. Initially, kids' job is to play. What I experienced is that when I played with them and really engaged with them, that the kind of relationship emerged became one that the work and the learning that we're quite serious about also became play. And so as kids matured, and you know, this is 9, 10, 11, 12, I think it's really important that they start participating in the work and the results of being in a family. But before that, I think it's really important that kids play, and I think it's very important that adults play with them. And that kind of relationship, where you get into their world and join them and engage with them in their reality, they're far more likely to come and carry on a conversation with you while you're washing the dishes, to be with you. And, you know, because we're designed to model. And so if we have that rich connection, I mean, first of all, bonding is the first important connection. And then often after that attachment, we abandon kids because mm-hmm. we don't play with them. We don't engage them. So it's very difficult then if we don't continue that important engagement relationship, it's very hard for them to model if they aren't still in that engaging relationship. And so certainly I've noticed that kids are really bonded and connected with their parents, tend to work alongside their parents, because modeling is what's built into their neurological structure as a strategy for survival. So kids mm-hmm. naturally work with adults. If the work is something that, again, is can emerge out of the relationship and out of the conversations that we have with kids.
I'm going to play a song called The Moon.
Thank you.
pretty amazing research coming out of cognitive neuroscience. Dr. Alan Shore, for example, is able to look at neurological development, 18, 20 years after the birthing experience. And there's actual neurological wiring and connections that take place in appropriate bonding experiences that allow young people in their teenage years to be able to be empathetic and to be able to have meaningful experiences with a sense of self and other. And there's evidence that in the language patterns and the thinking patterns of young people, if they don't have a bonding experience, the sense of self and the sense of other and the opportunity for empathetic kind of thinking is very difficult to impossible for people who haven't been bonded. And one of the key components of bonding is to share the same mental state, to be in the same emotional, mental quality of mind. And so I when I do my workshops around the country, I show two pictures. I show a picture of a father lying on the floor, and the baby is sitting on his chest, and they're looking face to face, they're touching skin to skin, their faces are a few inches apart, and they're connected, and they're mirroring each other. The father is making the sounds that the baby's making, that's influencing the father, that's influencing the baby. And this recursion, this round and round of mutual influencing, where the father goes to the mental state of the child, who's very much in the present moment. So the father has to let go of all of the busy things in his life and his thoughts and go to the state of the child, because there's no way the child can go to the state of the father. Then I show another picture of a baby in one of those plastic buckets that parents carry their kids around in nowadays, and it's sitting on the table, and the baby's in it, and the father's being a very attentive, typical, father looking after the kid, and he's got a cup of coffee in one hand, the newspaper under his arm, he's talking on the telephone to somebody at work, and he's fully clothed, he's standing 6 feet away from the baby, he's looking at the baby, but he's obviously engaged in conversation on the phone, and so although he's looking in the eyes of the baby is looking at a person who is not sharing the same mental state. So there's no opportunity for this recursion, this connection of one with the other. And these are the differences that are so important. So being present is essential for a parent to be able to connect with a child, because children live in the present moment. They haven't invented time until they're 3 or 4 years old, 5 years old. And so parenting for me in our parenting courses is a lot about practicing shutting down the mind and being present and engaging the young person in their state. Very important.
It's a gift to be simple. It's a gift to be free. It's a gift to come down where we are to be. And when we find ourselves in a place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we will not be ashamed. To turn and to turn will be our delight, for by turning and turning we'll come round right. It's a gift to be simple, it's a gift to be free, it's a gift to come down where we are to be. When we find ourselves in a place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend we will not be ashamed. To turn and to turn will be our delight, for
by turning and turning we'll come round right. It's a gift to be simple, it's a gift to be free, it's a gift to come down where we are to be. And when we find ourselves in a place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. It will be in the valley of love and delight.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
I think we learn more without being taught than we learn being taught. Far more. I think that, you know, we've got a culture right now, a paradigm, a belief system, a group of teachers who are certainly well-paid and well-reinforced by experts who say that learning doesn't take place unless you're taught. And yet I think the evidence, certainly from experiments like mine, and certainly the book that I've written, is a direct challenge to that assumption, because I think learning doesn't really take place, or a kind of learning that takes place from being taught is a very poor quality, low-order kind of learning. And I've recently, you know, this has been a 21-year experiment where I started out not really knowing any answers. I was willing to experiment and see what would happen. I'm absolutely thrilled with the results, and I'm just now compiling my understanding of what actually happened in those 21 years. And I've written it's a circular map of the 8 different kinds of learning. Only one of them is learning that emerges out of being taught. The other 7 is learning that occurs naturally in relationship, through discovery. One of the interesting kinds of learning that occurs is one that is the most mysterious, and that seems to be a kind of learning that takes place without even having experience, like let alone being taught. It almost doesn't take actual practical experience for this learning to take place. And so, just to speculate, I call it life quest learning, where somebody gets inside a deep sense that I want to be an astronaut, or I want to be a concert pianist, or I'm a ballet dancer. And whether it's a genetic predisposition, whether that information is embedded in the genes, or whether it's a reincarnation or even the morphogenic, the work of Rupert Sheldrake, whether we can actually access a field of unconscious information that's available around the Earth. We can't explain the Mozarts, we can't explain the Einsteins, we can't explain these huge leaps of knowledge and understanding that take place in certain individuals.
The end!
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper, I'm gonna daub myself with glue, stick some stamps on the top of my head, I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.